Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Lovely to have you here once again. It's my great pleasure this evening for our Friday talk to introduce Dr. Michael Best, Professor Emeritus in the Department of English, renowned teacher, scholar, editor, and the creator of Internet Shakespeare Editions, for which he's won great prizes. And it is, of course, global, so around the world, students and all of us have access to the best in Shakespearean editions, critical commentary, and production information. So Dr. Best has done something really very fantastic for the whole world. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Insight on the various Hamlets that there have been, not just the Marowitz and the Shakespeare. So, welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Linda, for that generous introduction. It's been an honor for UVic to have a director and playwright of the stature of Charles Marowitz with us, and it's been a wonderful opportunity for our students. It's equally an honor for me to be speaking to you this evening and to introduce the production in a small way. Now, as Linda says, I'm not a theater historian, I'm a Shakespeare scholar. So I'm going to share with you some thoughts on the Hamlet myth. It's a phrase that you'll see Mr. Marowitz uses in his introductory director's remarks in your program tonight, the Shakespeare myth. What I want to suggest is that the fascinating way that he reconfigures the play is actually part of a tradition that goes back a very long way. And somehow the Hamlet myth seems to have attracted this kind of treatment from the very beginning. The story starts with Amleth. Or actually, it goes back even further. There is a very similar legend in Roman times. Junius Brutus had adventures very similar to Amleth or our Hamlet. There are stories of fratricide, of incest, and crucially, escape from by the protagonist by feigning madness. And interestingly, both the names Brutus, as in Junius Brutus, Brutus and Amleth or Hamlet, both these names in their original languages mean fool. So in each case, the protagonist escapes by playing the fool. This slide I've got there in front of you, by the way, is a page on the Internet Shakespeare Editions where we look at the sources of all Shakespeare's plays. This is in the section on Shakespeare's life and times. In closer to Shakespeare's time, there was another play written probably about a decade before Shakespeare's own play, or maybe a little less than that, which is sometimes called the Hamlet. That is, it's lost, it doesn't survive, but we know it existed, and it was apparently quite popular because there are several references to it in the literature of the time. And one of my favorites is one by a fellow playwright of Shakespeare's, Thomas Lodge, who in one of his plays written in 1596, that's about 5 years before Shakespeare wrote his Hamlet, a character in this refers to a ghost, and he says that the ghost cried so miserably at the theater. The theatre, of course, was the name of one of the earliest theatres before the Globe was built. Cried so miserably at the theatre like an oyster wife. Hamlet, revenge! Oyster wife, of course, being a street saleswoman. So we know that there was this earlier play. We also know that Shakespeare had a habit of reconfiguring earlier plays. One of the best examples of this is his King Lear. There was an earlier play called The Chronicle History of King Lear. It was anonymous, and it followed the usual tradition, actually the historical tradition of the story of King Lear, by having a happy ending. That is to say, Cordelia's army wins the battle and she puts her dad back on the throne and he lives for another couple of years till he dies of natural causes. Well, Shakespeare's audience would have seen that in the theatre, and when they came to see his play, they would have been shocked by what they saw, because he turns the play totally upside down. So this is an example of the way that playwrights have always taken earlier works and reconfigured them to say new things. Shakespeare's own Hamlets, notice the plural. We have an edition of Hamlet on the Internet Shakespeare site. It's not completed yet. It's a huge job, and one of the advantages of publishing digitally is you can publish as things are completed. You don't have to wait for the final book to be done. It's being edited by a wonderful Shakespeare scholar, David Bevington. And if you look at the list of texts, there's a whole bunch of them. Starting at the bottom, there are the list of the three original ones. You see there's one in 1603, one in 1604, and one published with the collected works after Shakespeare's death in 1623. And incidentally, we've got all kinds of other goodies on the site. You can go and explore it for yourselves. But what about all these different Hamlets? Well, the two that we think are really closest to Shakespeare are the second quarto, and the folio, the one within his collected works. But interestingly enough, even these two, which are both considered to be quite authoritative, even these two vary quite a lot by over 250 lines. So clearly the play was being reconfigured on stage in Shakespeare's own lifetime. The other one, the very first version published, is really strange. It reconfigures in ways that are quite unexpected. Chunks of it look the same, or I should say sound the same. The speeches, the words, you remember, it sounds very similar, but then suddenly the words are all different, or the scenes are moved around, or a character has a new name. The one we know as Polonius is actually called Corambus for some reason. So there was some kind of reconfiguring going on, and there are all kinds of different theories as to what that might have been and why that happened. But the effect is quite fascinating in that I've chosen to put up there the most famous moment in Hamlet as you remember it, and as you see, if you're reading along with me, I should have a bouncing ball as I read this to show you. To be or not to be? Aye, there's the point. To die, to sleep, is that all? Aye, all. No, to sleep, to dream? Aye, marry, there it goes. For in that dream of death, when we awaken, born before an everlasting judge, from whence no passenger ever returned, it sounds kind of like the Hamlet we know. And many of you probably remember chunks of that to be or not to be soliloquy. It sounds like it, but it's not quite the same. So something has happened. Something has been reconfigured here. And what I'm suggesting is that this is a kind of practice, a normal kind of theatre practice in one way or another, to work over, to rethink, to reconfigure what has already been done. So, let me just close this tab. So, what about the Marowitz Hamlet? Well, I was fortunate enough to be for a period in London in the later 60s, and I was able to see a wonderful ferment of theatrical exploration and experimentation while I was there. And indeed, for over a decade, since the time of Beckett and other writers, England and Europe generally was immensely exciting in the theatrical world. There was a great deal of iconoclasm, of trying to do things a new way, of rethinking old things. And the list of names I've got up there will remind you of much of this. Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot, made people think in a very different way about what the stage could do, what a narrative might be. Joe Orton, some of you will know his wonderful black comedy, Loot. Well, Orton, actually I would say he rediscovered black comedy. We're used to it these days, but it was quite new in the period when Joe Orton was writing. One of the wonderful things that happened as a result of this is that we suddenly understood that earlier plays from the period I'm familiar with, the Elizabethan period, had also been using black comedy. I think of Christopher Marlowe especially. I think a lot of his plays, particularly The Jew of Malta, but also even Dr. Faustus, there's lots of black comedy there. And we didn't really know how to respond to that until Joe Orton showed us, oh, yes, it's funny because it makes us uncomfortable. So this was the kind of experimenting that was going on. The Theatre of the Absurd, Eugene Ionesco, there was Harold Pinter, and of course there was also Tom Stoppard, who was also having fun with Hamlet in his play. Many of you may be familiar with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. So what was happening was wonderful experimentation, and also experimentation with staging. Filmic effects were being used with spotlights, changes in lighting, things of this kind. The narrative structure changed so that you would get flashbacks and other things taken over from film. The stage technology was also changing, particularly in lighting, and this meant that you could have really elaborate productions. You know, we've heard about it. I don't know whether we've had too many of them in Victoria, but you can go over to Vancouver and see Cats or one of these magnificent spectacles. Well, at the same time as this technology was making special effects more spectacular, there was a really interesting reaction against that, towards minimalist staging, towards staging that let the words and the actors do the work, not all the gizmos. And this is one, again, Charles Marowitz spearheaded with Peter Brook in the Open Space Theatre in London. It was one of the most remarkable of these theatres and this movement back towards minimalism in theatre. So this was the context for the Marowitz Hamlet, a reconfiguring of Shakespeare's Hamlet. I was fortunate to see this production at the preview night earlier this week, and I have to say I thought it was a terrific production. And I'm not going to say too much about it because I want you to be surprised. But you will see a performance which is superbly directed by Charles Marowitz and Fran Gebhardt. You'll see UVic's young actors and crew dealing with a very challenging play with remarkable skill and aplomb. You'll see a play that completely rewrites Shakespeare's Hamlet in the sense that, well, the words are the same, but they appear in quite different places. Speeches are given to different characters. The order is switched around. Everything is mixed and matched in all kinds of fascinating and different and kaleidoscopic ways. What Mr. Marowitz does is to force us to rethink what is going on in Hamlet. And I want to close, I want to leave some time for questions, and I want to close by just making a couple of gentle suggestions. I think it's best if you enjoy the play without trying to put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. Don't treat it as a kind of intellectual brilliant scrabble, trying to fit things back where they came from, Oh, I remember. Actually, Laertes speaks that, not Gertrude. And it comes in Act 5, not Act 2. This kind of thing. You know, when I started watching it, part of me, I'm sorry, I couldn't help it, okay? Part of me was saying, oh, okay, I know where that came from. I know where that came from. You know, this kind of thing. And then I suddenly realized that I wasn't really listening. Or I was listening to the wrong things. I wasn't listening to the marrow at Hamlet. I was trying to reconstruct Shakespeare's Hamlet in my mind. And I suggest that you don't fall into that trap. Just enjoy it as it comes. Think of it perhaps as a crucible, as a prison. There's a very, very important image of prison. Denmark's a prison. Hamlet's mind is a prison. Think of it as a crucible where Marowitz creates a new chemical reaction from the same atoms, the same substance that is Hamlet, but it's a new chemical reaction. And this reaction is all taking place in Hamlet's mind. The focus is on Hamlet's mind, what's going on inside. And so everything that you see is his mind projecting. This mind of Hamlet, as we know from reading Shakespeare's Hamlet, this mind is under huge pressure from all kinds of things, especially the pressure to take revenge, especially the pressure from seeing the women in his life behave in ways that he thinks are betraying him and his father. His mind is under huge pressure. It's always on the verge of breaking down. It's always on that fine line between sanity and insanity. And it's always in danger of fracturing completely. That, it seems to me, is the way that I came to understand and to enjoy the play, by thinking of it as that re-exploration of the language and of Hamlet in this exploration of Hamlet's mind. So the most important thing for you all to do is to enjoy. So if you have any questions. Yes. Sorry, I'm sort of blinded by the lights up here. Did I see somebody with a... Oh, yes, please.
Has the play been improved?
It's a different play. I think that this performance is a wonderful play of the Marowitz Hamlet. No, I don't think you try to improve on Shakespeare, but you can use Shakespeare to do different things, just as Shakespeare himself used others. And I think all the time we do that sort of thing. So no, it's not improved, but it is reinterpreted for a different age and for a different time. Shakespeare's own Hamlet is capable of being reinterpreted for a new age and for a new time. And we've seen it on film. I don't know if you've seen the very modern version of Hamlet directed by Michael Almereyda, starring Ethan Hawke as Hamlet, set in a sort of very contemporary New York. That's a new Hamlet, a new Shakespeare Hamlet for today, though it's repurposed in a lot of ways. It's because it's on film, it's much shorter and so on. I wouldn't say that's better either. It's different. It's a new exploration. So, good question, but it's actually a different play. Yes. You recognize long speeches that are all the same. And yes, it's in iambic pentameter because that's what the language is. Yes, so it's a kind of a tour de force of taking something and transmuting it into this. That's why I use the image of the crucible. There's some alchemy involved here, I think. Yes, at the back.
It's speculative, I guess, but how much do you think this approach to reconfiguring gives the players new scope for interpreting?
That's a really interesting question. And one of the things that really impressed me about the performance is how well the actors spoke the lines. It's not easy to speak Shakespeare's lines. And I have heard very good companies with actors who really don't know. They try to turn the verse into prose, or they try to act by shouting loudly instead of letting it come from the heart or whatever. So yes, they have really learned to speak these lines. And I would say that it must have been an extraordinarily rich learning experience for them, both in terms of getting a chance to do Hamlet, wow, speak those lines, wow, and also getting a chance to do a really interesting modern retake on Hamlet. Ask the actors, but I bet they had a wonderful time. Yes.
Do you know when this Marowitz Hamlet was first performed? How many times has it been performed since?
Well, I'm sure there are those who can answer that. I think it was 1968, I think, was the first performance. I don't know how often it's been played since. It's been published in a collection of various reinterpretations of Shakespeare that Mr. Marowitz has written. So, yes, it's been around for quite a long time, and it has been re-performed quite frequently. Yes? One, two. Yes. That's a question dear to my heart. As the director of a website, I would love to be able to use lots of stuff that's in copyright. I would love to be able to have videos of modern movies of Hamlet, but of course they're all in copyright. And in Shakespeare's time, copyright simply did not exist. Printers, oddly enough, had rights. You weren't allowed to pinch a play or a work that had been ascribed to a printer, and there was a book called The Stationer's Register, which carefully put all these down, and we know the printers had rights over them. The authors, none, absolutely none. The impresario of the period and the rival company to Shakespeare's, Philip Henslow, would pay a really good writer like Ben Jonson £5 for a play, and once he got his £5, that was it. He would, by the way, spend £7 on a new costume for his main actor. Yes?
As this play has been performed since 1968, have we managed to have Mr. Marowitz here with us in Victoria? As a producer, it seems like quite an amazing find for a piece of luck.
Now, that's a question you will have to ask somebody in the theatre department. I'm sorry, I don't know how they managed to... Sorry?
Yeah, I can give some insight.
Yes, please, Linda.
Yeah. We had Mr. Marowitz here about 4 years ago to a workshop with our students in the McIntyre Theatre. And he did this Hamlet then. But it was for a very small in-house audience, essentially. Then last year, he wrote to us and said he enjoyed himself so much, he would love to come back. And we thought, my goodness, our good luck is tremendous. So we said, yes, please, Mr. Marowitz, would you come back? And that's how the whole thing began. Unfortunately, Mr. Marowitz has been in very poor health, so he was not able to come for the entire rehearsal period. And Fran Gephardt had stood by as his right-hand woman and associate director on the project. And so when it was clear that he was not able to sustain being with us for the whole of the rehearsal period, Fran was able to step in and carry on. So that was sort of at the, we had about 2.5 to 3 weeks left before opening. But that's how it came about. So the students had the opportunity and the real privilege of learning from Charles Marowitz himself and having the opportunity to work with him on his vision of the play. And they had blocked it. And then Frank Gephardt was able to step in and finish staging it. So you have, in a sense, the best of both worlds.
Thank you, Linda. Yes.
On the subject of copyright, today do you think Shakespeare would be considered a plagiarist for just stealing some stories?
I think the whole idea of intellectual property and plagiarism and so on was very foreign to his period. In a way, I kind of regret that free-for-all. It seems to me that there was this wonderful freedom to, in a sense, all plays written in the period were collaborative. Actually, a large number of them were written by more than one author. But even those that were written by one author were collaborative because they were pulling together pieces that were done by others. And there's good evidence that some of Shakespeare's plays have scenes that were added later by other hands. So, yes, the whole attitude was... It's actually, in an interesting way, it was actually much more like screenplays for television today, where you often have several writers collaborating to produce a screenplay. So it was that kind of popular theater that Shakespeare was part of. And the whole cult of the author and of intellectual property happened very much later. Oh, yes, thank you.
I was turning over in my mind the question of how you would feel as a webmaster with the idea that, in fact, you could extend this whole process into a collaborative workspace where everybody was contributing to the final product, picking up text from one place and moving it to the next, and somebody else feeling they can improve on the final product. So very collaborative kind of product. Image emerges.
Well,
you want to run?
I'm an old-fashioned scholar. I put a quality firewall around my site. But what you're talking about is something close to the Wikipedia model. And I have to say that the wiki model is a very productive one. And I think, though Wikipedia got a very bad press at the beginning, I think that it has, generally speaking, proven itself. And the point is that it keeps getting better and better. And there's no question that there are ways in which you can, as they say, crowdsource various types of scholarly activity. You have to put checks and balances in place, but it's a very exciting field to be working in, partly for that reason. And because it has a global reach, it means that both the audience and the participants can be from all over the place. This is something that I at least find very exciting. So thank you for asking that question. Oh, you just we. Couple more questions.
So we have here about a couple more questions. We have time for them. Anyone else? Yes.
This is not a question. This is a comment.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to thank you very much for your intellectual but personable approach to this. I've learned so much that I didn't know, and I think we all have. And I thank you very much.
Oh well, thank you. Well, thank you. And I do hope that you'll find the intellectual stimulus exciting. You know, just again, it is a bit like Scrabble. Scrabble pushes the mind a little further. A good play or a good book pushes the mind a little further, sometimes makes it a little bit uncomfortable. But you go away and you're talking and you're arguing and you're thinking. And that's what good literature does.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Well, again,
okay.
Dr. Best, thank you so very much for coming, and thank you all very, very much for having me.